Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, January 12th, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. After that, I'll read an article from the Humanity Behind the Headlines section, and then I'll read the explainer, followed by the Home Forum, and then the Monitor's View. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled, What National Anniversaries Can Show Us? This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who is the print editor, and you can email her at haness@csmonitor.com. And she writes, This year marks 25 years since Al-Qaeda flew planes into the Twin Towers of New York City's World Trade Center and the Pentagon in Northern Virginia. The attack was motivated by a violent sectarian interpretation of Islam espoused by Osama bin Laden, which departed from most Muslims' peaceful and inclusive version of their faith, according to the 9/11 Commission report. Still, the attack prompted a 17-fold spike in hate crimes against Muslim Americans. Much has been written about how 9/11 changed the United States. As staff writer Audrey Thibert reports in this week's issue, there is a lot to consider about how New York City specifically has evolved since that attack. Marwa Janini, who was 10 years old in September of 2001, told Audrey that she remembers, even as a child, the feelings of mistrust that arose after the attack, even after courts declared the New York Police Department's surveillance of many Muslim communities to be illegal. Nobody then would have imagined that New York would have a Muslim mayor, she says. Today, Mr. Janini is part of the transition team for Zohran Mamdani, a Muslim American elected mayor of the nation's largest city. He didn't win in a landslide. Nearly half of New York City voters cast their ballots against Mr. Mamdani. Many critics decried his democratic socialist economic politics, while others objected to his positions on Israel. Nevertheless, his victory would have seemed culturally and politically impossible 25 years ago, according to Audrey's reporting. His faith was not an insurmountable barrier, reflecting an evolution of thought among New Yorkers. This perhaps is a different way to look at national anniversaries. They're not just events that changed history. Often they are milestones that help us recognize the ways communities have evolved over time and the changing ways people think. And that was the From the Editor column this week written by Stephanie Haynes, who's the print editor. And it was entitled, What National Anniversaries Can Show Us? And now for the cover story. It's entitled, Seeking Opportunities to Explore Outside of Yourself. The benefits of studying abroad can be life-changing. Advocates want more black men to participate. And this is written by Ira Porter, who's a staff writer. And way down here, about four pages later, we have that paragraph called Why We Wrote This. And it says, Study abroad benefits include better retention, economic capital, and upward mobility. So why do so few black men get that opportunity? Our reporter always regretted not taking advantage of study abroad himself, so he searched for black male college students to document their overseas experiences. Okay, I'll scroll all the way to the top here. From Tokyo, in the middle of a blistering August day, Tremaine Collins is standing on the platform of the Oku train station in Tokyo, punching a code into an app on his phone to pay for his ticket. It's a busy central hub in the Kita district where passengers connect to an array of places in one of the most sprawling metropolises in the world. Mr. Collins is getting the hang of navigating his new city. Today, he's dressed in blue jeans, comfortable yet stylish silver low tops, and a multi-hued brown plaid shirt mixed with maroon. His buttons are open, exposing a white tank top and a gold necklace and pendant. He's one of only two black men on the busy platform at the moment, and one is relatively few in Japan. I'm not here because I'm here on vacation, he says. I'm here because this is a goal that I've always wanted to get here. Mr. Collins has just begun his first year at Temple University, Japan, where about half of its 3,000 students are from the United States and roughly a quarter are from Japan. He is not simply doing a semester abroad program. He is enrolled as a full-time student in a four-year undergraduate program. This makes Mr. Collins stand out in other ways. Very few U.S. black men attending a college or university take advantage of opportunities to study abroad. In the 2023 to 2024 school year, there were almost 300,000 Americans studying in other countries. About two-thirds of these students were white, according to the Institute for International Education, and 6% were black. While men made up one-third of American study abroad, black men were only 2% of that total, experts say. I mean, this is the $20 million question, literally. It's been a topic of conferences since forever, says Tonija Hope, who leads the study abroad program at Howard University in Washington, D.C., a historically black college. She and others want to know why black males don't study abroad and what can be done to get them to participate. The benefits can be life-changing. Research indicates that studying abroad strengthens retention and completion rates. It makes job applicants more attractive to hiring managers, and it increases social and economic capital to further upward mobility. Mr. Collins says he always wanted to do different things when he was growing up in Lorain, Ohio, a steel town on the shore of Lake Erie. He loved Pokemon and anime, Japanese animation, which his peers often mocked. Later, he wasn't very interested in sports or hip-hop music. He gets choked up remembering that time. My dad wasn't really in my life like that. It was really just my mom and my grandma. He says feelings of neglect and loneliness always made him look in the mirror and speak words of affirmations to himself. I'm a good person. I have a good heart. I wanted to learn just how to be a better man and to be someone who's brave, who's courageous, someone who's intelligent and really in tune with themselves, Mr. Collins says. One thing he did wish to do was to travel. No one in his immediate family had ever traveled outside the U.S., not himself, his older brother, or his two sisters. He made a radical decision. After he graduated from high school, to his family's disbelief, he enlisted in the Air Force and was stationed in Montana. I didn't really have nobody to believe in me until I did certain things that were outside the box, he says, holding back tears. After 3 years of military service, the GI Bill helped fund his college plans. The two schools he applied to were both overseas, a university in Rome and the American University of Paris, where he was accepted and attended for a year. But a chance encounter with French police made him decide to leave. Officers stopped him and aggressively frisked him. The incident replays in his mind like a scene from a movie. They pull you over because you're black and maybe they think you fit a profile. It feels uncomfortable. You're nervous and scared, he recalls. Between the semesters in France, he traveled. He visited several countries in Europe and then went to Asia, stopping in Tokyo. Before heading back to his Paris dorm, he had one more stop in Austria, but he says he kicked himself for not spending more time in Japan. That's when he decided to apply to Temple University Japan. I think if you have the opportunity to do something where you can explore outside of yourself, and if you want to not do it and blame it on fear, I think you're doing yourself an injustice, he says, wishing more people from where he grew up felt the same. Overcoming the four F's. Decades ago, Marjorie Gans, a professor at Spelman College in Atlanta, wrote a paper, The Four F's, Overcoming Barriers to Study Abroad, an examination of the reasons black students do not take advantage of overseas programs. The four F's she identified are family, finances, fear, and faculty. Studying abroad is a new experience for families, especially for first-generation or low-income students. But families can also limit opportunities simply because of their lack of familiarity with international travel and the value of such studies. Finances, too, might often be a problem for black students who, as a whole, don't always have the resources of their white counterparts. Fear of racism abroad is a major concern for black students and their families. Living in foreign countries can heighten experiences of microaggressions and discrimination. There is also the fear of isolation and of being the only Black student within a given program. Then there is simply the fear of the unknown. In 2014, then First Lady Michelle Obama spoke about studying abroad during a trip to China, where she told students at Peking University in Beijing that she was afraid and unaware of the full opportunities available to her when she was an undergraduate at Princeton University in New Jersey. "The benefits of studying abroad are almost endless," Mrs. Obama said. She spoke about the practice making Americans more appealing in the job market and more compassionate, and how it forces students out of their comfort zones. Dr. Gantz's final F, faculty, refers to the structural issues in study abroad programs, including insufficient outreach to Black students. "But there are other reasons for lower participation rates," says Dr. Hope at Howard. "There is a lot of speculation, but one to start with is a low enrollment rate in higher ed across the board," Dr. Hope says. "When you already have low numbers, then how do you convince those that are in higher ed to go?" she asks. But she also mentions a fifth F. "I would add, in the case of like Howard and many HBCUs, and probably universities generally, FOMO." It's all uppercase letters, F-O-M-O. "At Howard, in the fall, you don't want to miss homecoming," Dr. Hope says. "If you're pledging a fraternity or sorority, you don't want to miss rush. And then, in the spring, you don't want to miss other things. Elections for student government, you miss that. There's always something that is going to be missed." In 2025, too, all study abroad programs took a hit. In August, the State Department scrapped $100 million in cultural exchange programs, calling them low priority. President Donald Trump has also made it more difficult for foreign students to study in the U.S., which has advocates concerned about opportunities for American students seeking to go overseas. "It is dire now," says James Hamm, Director of International Affairs at North Carolina Central University, of these cuts. But he believes funding will eventually return and that schools have to be ready. "We have to find ways to continue to prepare our students going forward," he says. Dr. Hope says that a decade ago, Howard students voted to be charged a $100 globalization fee for study abroad initiatives. She wants more to follow through and go. In 2024, more than 200 Howard students studied abroad, but that's still far from the 10% of students she would like to see. "The goal for me is the longer term. You need to unpack a suitcase, you need to learn a bus route to get you somewhere, and you have to figure out how to do that on your own," Dr. Hope says. If you saw what I saw. Ruby Maddox devoted much of her career to getting more men to travel abroad. In 2016, she helped found Leaders of the Free World, a nonprofit that works to empower Black men. She facilitated leadership training and international travel for her clients. Ms. Maddox said studying abroad helped expand her own worldview in a profound way after she decided to visit Ghana in 2010. "I went over there to study urban agriculture for a summer," she told the Monitor, reflecting on how she used a $5,000 student aid refund to fund the trip, which she researched and planned herself. "Initially, her plan was, I'm going to go over there. I'm going to study urban agriculture and focus on the work that I'm doing. And then it hit me," she said during a Zoom interview last year. "There was the whole aspect of how I'm traveling abroad for the first time in a country where everybody around looked like me." She saw Black professionals, professors, and government officials. Ms. Maddox says the experience of not being the other or the only Black student in a room helped her make a shift in her life when she returned to Springfield, Massachusetts. "To this day, I have no words. It's like you see that the work is bigger," Ms. Maddox recalled. "I felt like I wanted more young people to have this experience. I settled on a lot of young men, in my family and the young men in my community who had this potential that was off the charts. And I would say to myself, if you saw what I saw, you would be unstoppable. Weeks after her interview with the Monitor, Ms. Maddox died unexpectedly. The leadership nonprofit began, in fact, when she and co-founder LeVar Thomas took a group of men on a two-week trip to Ghana. After the first trip was a success, she continued to take groups of 15 or so black college students from across the country. She partnered with schools including the University of Delaware, Prairie View A&M University in Texas, and New Jersey City University. Dr. Hamm at North Carolina Central is on the board of Leaders of the Free World, and he travels with the group to Ghana. For years, he worked with the Peace Corps, working his way up to country director in Uganda, Cameroon, and South Africa. He then served as deputy country director for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Zambia, Guinea, and Ivory Coast. When he started at the Peace Corps in 1996, he was the only black man in his group, which also included one black woman from Alabama. I want to inspire African Americans to really pursue these kinds of career opportunities, especially for our young, because when it comes to participation in international affairs and study abroad opportunities, we are the least to participate. And more so, African American men are least exposed to that, Dr. Hamm says. This has been my mission. The groups that Leaders of the Free World brings to Africa are hosted by faculty, students, and leaders at the University of Ghana in Accra. The exchange students focus on leadership and service, including political leadership. They do projects such as building a kitchen for a school whose roof collapsed. They meet new people, try new food, and learn traditional African dance. This was the vision of the late Ms. Maddox. That really was the seed that I wanted to plant, that seed of seeing yourself being unstoppable, of seeing yourself beyond what they told you you were, even if for those 2 weeks you could step outside of those perceived boundaries that you had physically and mentally, she told the Monitor. Not all butterflies and rainbows. When he was a junior at Georgia State University, Timothy Mason studied abroad in Lisbon, Portugal, from August to December in 2024. He loved it, but it didn't come without obstacles. His family was afraid, but his worried mother eventually relented and let him go. She even flew with him to Portugal to help him settle in. Though there were students from all over the U.S., Mr. Mason and a friend from Spelman College were the only two black students. There was only one other person of color in their group of 20. An environmental science major, Mr. Mason, says he's not uncomfortable in such white spaces, but being isolated in Lisbon highlighted differences. Our lived experiences are different, and it's hard not to have somebody to relate to, because white experience is very different from the black experience when I'm trying to make friends with people, he says. In Portugal, during the 2024 presidential election for which he filed an absentee ballot, he discussed the results between former Vice President Kamala Harris, a black and Asian woman, and President Trump. Some members of his group asserted that racism and sexism were not issues in the race. I feel like that's something to present for me, and I'm not even a woman, but just being black and knowing that everything is not all butterflies and rainbows, and that racism actually happens to people, he recalls. It was one of those things where I had to have patience. Nihongo Nomi, and in parentheses it says Japanese only. Days before classes start, Mr. Collins is participating in opening week activities. Today is the day to tour campus buildings, potentially meet faculty, and decide whether he wants to join a student group. Everything from jujitsu to the chess club. The day will conclude with a party and live music. His tour guide, a senior named Kenya Douglas, walks with a group of 20 students to the Welcome Center. Mr. Collins asks questions about navigating the city. If you see a sign that says Nihongo Nami, or Japanese only, or Gaiko Kujin, Oka Tawari, no foreigners, don't go in there. Mr. Douglas warns, some places are not foreign friendly. Mr. Collins is eager for the first day of classes. All courses at Temple University Japan are taught in English, but the art major wants to learn Japanese. His first class, in fact, is Japanese Elements 1. On the first day, his instructor, Takeda Sota, is going over hiragana and katakana, the writing shapes and characters for the Japanese language. The first day went really well, Mr. Collins says, and he's confident that he would be happy studying in Tokyo for the next few years. In fact, he can partially see the future, he says, when it comes to his time studying in Japan. I think my older self is going to be proud of my younger self. Sometimes I feel you've got to step away from the culture to try to find out what you actually like, Mr. Collins says. That's what we know, but if you don't step outside of America and you're African-American and that's all you know is hip-hop culture, you don't look outside to find out who you are. And as a note here, this story was produced with support from the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship Program. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for an article in the Humanity Behind the Headlines section. This one's entitled, Mamdini's Rise Reflected in Muslim Neighborhood That Was Targeted After 9/11. This is written by Audrey Thibert, a staff writer, and there is that paragraph why we wrote this. Muslims in New York's Bay Ridge neighborhood remember the days of suspicion and fear that followed the 9/11 attack. They cannot have foreseen a day that has now arrived, the election of a Muslim as New York City mayor. From New York, Marwi Giannini was 10 years old and growing up in Brooklyn on September 11, 2001. In a follow-up of the al-Qaeda attack that killed almost 3,000 people and destroyed the World Trade Center's Twin Towers 25 years ago this year, she remembers intense surveillance and fear in the Muslim and Arab community. And she remembers thinking that the people targeted in the wake of the attack needed a way for their voices to be heard. Now she leads an organization providing that representation, the Arab American Association of New York, and she is at the center of something that might have felt unthinkable to her and others 25 years ago. She's part of the transition team for New York's first Muslim mayor, Zohran Mamdani, who was set to be sworn in when this story went to press. Mr. Mamdani got nearly 51% of the vote in a mayoral election that saw the highest turnout since 1969, winning a diverse mix of voters. In Bay Ridge, a neighborhood in southwestern Brooklyn, with the largest Arab community in New York City and a significant Muslim population, Mr. Mamdani netted the majority of the votes. Over decades, the Bay Ridge neighborhood has transformed from a hotspot of European immigrants to a place now known informally as Little Palestine or Little Yemen, especially around Fifth Avenue between 67th and 75th Streets. There, storefront signs are often in Arabic, recordings of the Quran play on TVs and radios in the neighborhood shops, and the call to prayer, or adhan, rings out from the local mosque. Many Muslim New Yorkers see Mr. Mamdani as willing to take on the city's affordability crisis. His victory has also prompted reflection on their community's journey, from political marginalization to one of their own becoming New York's top elected official. The story of Muslim New Yorkers and Arab New Yorkers isn't one of linear progress, says Ms. Giannini. There are a lot of complexities. It's a community that has to continuously fight to feel safe and supported and seen. Mr. Mamdani, while vowing to be a mayor for all New Yorkers, made a direct promise to Muslims in his victory speech. He said that over 1 million Muslims in the city will now know that they belong, not just in the five boroughs of the city, but in the halls of power. The most salient moment. After 9/11, a covert counterterrorism program by the New York Police Department targeted Muslims and people of Middle Eastern descent across Bay Ridge and other neighborhoods. The Arab American Association of New York, mosques, student groups, and businesses were police targets. A 2013 lawsuit accused the NYPD of civil rights violations, arguing that it surveilled Muslims without cause. The settlement led to major reforms within the department, including a prohibition on investigations based on race, religion, or ethnicity. Asad Dandia, one of the plaintiffs, had discovered that the NYPD infiltrated a charity he co-founded. The case pushed him into community organizing. It was probably the most visible and salient moment in our history where we actually took a stand against discrimination and injustice perpetrated by city government, Mr. Dandia says. In 2013, organizers launched the Muslim Democratic Club of New York to mobilize voters. Mr. Mamdani's chief counsel on his transition team helped found the group. 4 years later, Mr. Mamdani served as canvassing director for Kader El Yatim, a Palestinian-American and a Lutheran pastor who ran for city council in Bay Ridge. Despite Mr. El Yatim's loss, the campaign helped activate people there, and Mr. Mamdani's political career can trace its roots to the work he did in Bay Ridge. Culturally, the community continues to evolve. Just 3 years ago, a woman named Basma, who asked that only her first name be used for privacy reasons, arrived here from Algeria. "I heard people speaking Arabic, and there was a store that had Algerian music," she says. "It's all the same as Algeria. At least hear us." Amir Ali, a Yemeni business owner in Bay Ridge, says he is glad to have Mr. Mamdani representing Muslims in public life. "It does matter to me to have a nice picture of Islam other than what the media shows," Mr. Ali says. "That's what we care about. He is showing the American Muslim as we want him to." But what matters most to Mr. Ali and others interviewed is affordability. A poll in early 2025 found that 61% of New Yorkers said meeting basic needs is increasingly difficult, and almost half of respondents had considered leaving the city. Mr. Ali has personal experience with that. He says monthly rent for his shop has increased by around $2,000 in the past few years. "A lot of people voted for Mr. Mamdani, not just Muslims, not just Middle Easterners, because all these people are struggling," Mr. Ali says. "They need somebody to at least, even if he's not going to fix it, look at it, at least hear us." A Democratic Socialist, Mr. Mamdani has an agenda that includes things such as city-owned grocery stores and rent freezes. His political opponents have seized on that. "Yes, he says he's a socialist," said Republican U.S. Representative Nicole Meltiotakis, whose district includes most of Bay Ridge. "But guess what, my friends? Those are policies straight out of the communist playbook of Karl Marx." Mr. Mamdani also faces headwinds among other constituencies in the city, which is home to the largest Jewish population outside Israel. Some of his public statements related to the war in Gaza have been criticized by Jewish organizations and leaders, including when he apparently declined to condemn the phrase "globalize the Intifada," a saying they believe condones violence against Jews. Mr. Mamdani has said it is not language he uses. In an October debate, he said he recognizes Israel's right to exist, but would not recognize any state's right to exist with a system of hierarchy on the basis of race or religion. Still, about one-third of New York Jews voted for Mr. Mamdani, and he has said he will be a mayor that protects Jewish New Yorkers. His pro-Palestinian stance, meanwhile, has earned him support. About 44% of registered voters in the city sympathized more with Palestinians compared with 26% who sympathized more with Israel, according to a New York Times and Siena University poll from September. Ms. Giannini, a Palestinian-American, says it was once unimaginable to her that elected officials in a country that aligns so closely with Israel would publicly express support for Palestinians. Mr. Dandia, an urban history tour guide in New York who is on Mr. Mamdani's informal advisory team, says the new mayor's stance attracted many voters who had felt politically invisible on the issue. Zarina Agriwal, An associate professor of religious studies at Yale University says that the post 9/11 period has been a politically transformative time for Muslims in New York City. It was the social welfare issues of poverty, surveillance, racism, unequal access, discrimination in schools and healthcare that really got Muslim New Yorkers to come together despite their political differences, Professor Gruel says. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week it's entitled, Rent Control is Popular. Can it help a housing crisis? And they have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. Across the United States, jurisdictions are seeking to enact rent regulations as housing costs have continued to rise. But finding long-term solutions, like building millions more homes, won't be easy. This is written by Cameron Poo, who is a staff writer. Introductory economics classes often teach that rent control is bad policy. Artificially capping prices, the argument goes, discourages production, in this case, the creation and maintenance of apartments. That leads to housing shortages and higher rents market-wide. Yet the idea continues to gain traction and is garnering new attention across the United States. Zohran Mamdani, who was scheduled to take office as New York City mayor in January, as this article went to press, is insisting on freezing rents for some 2 million New Yorkers. Nationwide, jurisdictions are seeking to enact rent regulations as housing costs have continued to rise, particularly in large cities. City councilors in Los Angeles, for example, voted in November to reduce the annual rent increase limit for most of the city's apartments from 8% to 4%. Washington State capped annual rent increases at up to 10% last spring. Washington, D.C., which already restricts rent increases, is considering a ballot initiative that would freeze rents entirely for 2 years. And later this year, Massachusetts residents will likely vote on a ballot question that would cap rent increases at the rate of inflation up to a maximum of 5%. Many cities have regulated rents for decades, but the recent surge in new initiatives has reignited debate about the government's role in the free market. Supporters pitch rent regulation as a necessary measure to redress an affordability crisis. Many economists remain skeptical, arguing that such tactics raise costs over the long term, exacerbate shortages, and lower housing quality. Manuel Pastor, an economist and a sociology professor at the University of Southern California, reflects a different, more measured viewpoint among some housing policy experts. This is one of those debates where the ideological heat does not really match the empirical fire, he says. Rent stabilization is one tool. Why would you put that tool away? And now what follows is a question and answer piece. Question. Why are supporters pushing for rent control now? Answer. Those who advocate rent control argue that housing costs for working families have reached a level at which the government must intervene to reduce them. Something has got to give, says Tara Raghuvir, who heads the Tenant Union Federation, a national organization that supports federal rent control. The only urgent solution that makes sense at scale is rent control. In 2023, half of renters in the United States qualified as cost burdened, meaning they spent more than 30% of their income on housing utilities. Some 27% spent half of their income on housing and utilities. Most of those burdened renters lived in one of the nation's 50 biggest cities. Rent regulation is also popular with voters, and that may be driving political action. In a 2024 Redfin survey, 82% of respondents supported limits on rent increases. Researchers say such regulation historically has emerged amid housing market duress, starting amid World War I as building materials were siphoned off to support the war, and housing construction declined. Congress also froze rents on 80% of the nation's rental stock during World War II. By the mid-1970s, such strict freezes and ceilings had given way to stabilization policies, which allow rents to change, but with limits. Rent-stabilized cities include Washington, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, as well as New York, where about 1 million apartments are rent-stabilized, and 69% of residents lease their homes. Question: who opposes rent control and why? Answer: opponents argue that rent control is not a viable long-term solution, exacerbates shortages, and increases housing costs. They say it's not just a coincidence that cities with rent control rank high on lists of places with large housing shortages. It only worsens the housing crisis, says Tamara Small, CEO of the Massachusetts branch of the Commercial Real Estate Development Association. It reduces the total number of units and reduces the quality of those units. Economists have long argued the same. In a 2012 poll of economists by the University of Chicago, more than 80% opposed rent control. Only 2% supported it. In 2024, after Montgomery County, Maryland, implemented a rent stabilization program, investment in multifamily rental homes fell by 13%, according to the Wall Street Journal. Part of the pushback concerns housing quality. With lower rents, landlords have less revenue to allocate to repairs, which can increase undesirable housing stock in New York and elsewhere. To be put on the market again, units may need hundreds of thousands of dollars in repairs, repairs that owners are unwilling to make because they worry rent revenue won't cover costs. Question: what does the research say? Answer: researchers generally agree that regulations are effective in reducing rents for tenants in affected units. A 2014 study estimated that rents in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where rent control was was in effect from 1970 to 1994, were 44% lower in regulated units than in non-regulated units. In 2022, a review of 31 rent control studies found that 25 documented lower rents in rent-controlled units. Those cost savings also tend to lead to more extended residences, and that stability can have social benefits for families. But longer tenancies can lead to a mismatch between tenants' needs and the housing they receive, some economists argue. A family may choose to stay in a rent-controlled unit even as they outgrow it, for example. Rent control can also lead to a net loss of rental units. A 2019 study of San Francisco found that an expansion of rent control reduced the number of multifamily rental homes by 15%, as some landlords tried to recoup lost returns by converting their units into condominiums. The reduction in rental housing supply likely increased rents in the long run, the study concluded. Carefully crafting new rent regulations may be the key to preventing marketplace harm, Professor Pastor says. Unlike more rigid rent control measures, many modern rent stabilization policies permit some rent increases, helping landlords to cover repair costs. And they exempt newly built units to mitigate the risk of reduced construction. And the final question: what are other ways to stabilize or lower housing prices? And the final answer: advocates on all sides of the debate agree that to lower rents in the long run, the U.S. must build more housing. The price of any good tends to rise when the demand outpaces supply, and the housing construction has struggled to keep pace with population growth since the 2008 recession. A recent Goldman Sachs research report found that the U.S. needs to build between 3 million and 4 million homes to close the gap. Changing zoning laws to streamline regulations and eliminate parking minimums could make it easier to build apartment buildings, as current requirements often add tens of thousands of dollars in construction costs. But building millions of new homes will take time. It's also likely to run into NIMBYism, the idea that building certain types of additional housing degrades communities. Some advocates have also argued that rent control policies increase support for new housing. A 2022 study found that residents of rent-controlled apartments were 37 percentage points more likely to support new housing construction in their neighborhoods, perhaps because it makes occupants less worried about gentrification and displacement. And now we find ourselves in the home forum section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article and there's a poem. So here's the article, The Cycles of Life. The rhythms of laundry, rocking restless babies to the hum of the dryer, washing the grass stains of growing children, mirror life. This is written by Danny Heitman, and here we go. When my wife and I heard a plaintive whinny from her laundry room the other day, we knew that our old dryer had cycled its last load. The dryer had lasted 3 decades, long enough to tumble my daughter's toddler clothes and her husband jeans many years later. We had gotten our money's worth from an appliance we'd purchased as newlyweds, and I couldn't complain when its bearings finally gave out. Waiting for the store van to bring a replacement, I glanced at the old dryer, its top as rusty as an ancient freighter resting in dry dock. Before the kids grew up and left home, we probably averaged 4 loads a week, a perpetual spin of socks and towels, shirts and blouses, and the occasional dog blanket for a terrier whose bed was plusher than mine. In the winter of 2000, we sometimes ran the dryer with nothing in it. Our newborn son, restless at midnight, found the gentle hum of the rotating drum a soothing lullaby. I held him near the dryer so often that I put a chair beside it, sometimes dozing off myself as a mechanical murmur put me back to sleep. In those cold, dark hours, the laundry room seemed like the gently beating heart of our house, and perhaps it was. Juice and milk often spilled over the family dinner table back then, flooding laps large and small, like a river cresting its banks. Our youngsters muddied pants and dresses as they scurried around the lawn, their knees and elbows still marked by the yard's wild embrace when they came back inside. Grass stains and blueberry blotches colored their clothing as brightly as a canvas by Monet. Our washer and dryer, always full, greeted us each day like rumbling horns of plenty, the sweet floral scent of each warm load perfuming our den with a subtle grace note. Grace, though, isn't what I usually felt as I fed armfuls of boxer shorts and t-shirts into the dryer each week. I came to think myself as a sailor shoveling coal while our household slowly steamed its way through the seasons, our destination not always clear. Laundry and other humble routines of parenthood sometimes made me restless, and I'd sigh and hope for a day when I might be able to focus on higher things. But some wise words from writer Kathleen Norris helped me keep things in perspective. As she deftly noted, to call a household chore menial is to invoke a Latin word meaning to remain or to dwell in a household. In this way, Ms. Norris pointed out, the tasks we often regard as domestic drudgery are really about connections, about family and household ties. It's something I've reflected on more deeply in my new life as an empty nester, with our daughter and son now grown and living far away. Our washer and dryer are quieter these days, but when our children return for visits, we once again do their laundry in a small gesture of homecoming. The simple chore is a reminder that, in washing their pajamas and folding their slacks, we'll always be ready with a warm welcome. As the dryer spins, I'm reminded of the circularity of my life, its predictable cycles, perhaps seen most ideally as a source of discovery rather than dullness. The ordinary activities I find most compatible with contemplation, Ms. Norris told readers, are walking, baking bread, and doing laundry. Which is why there might be nothing nobler than a batch of clean clothes. Or so I told myself as I opened our new dryer and pitched in its first load. Okay, now for this poem. This thing is written weirdly. There's no uppercase letters and there's no punctuation. This is entitled Seasons and is written by Peter Joseph Glavigzi. Winter thaw in the distance, new moon. Spring melt, finding the mitten I lost last year. Summer days, pouring another glass. Autumn evening, one more page in the novel. Snow where the lawn used to be. And finally, and I use that word facetiously, We are at the Monitor's View in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and this will take me about 6 minutes to read, and we have 13 minutes left. Here we go. A yearning for the sacred in civic life. Many Americans feel buffeted by a cycle of tit-for-tat political rhetoric, whipsaw policymaking, and norms breaking. A recent poll found 82% of voters believe the way people talk about politics contributes to violence. Only one-third say it's possible to lower the temperature on rhetoric. Yet more voices are calling for civic civility. The calls are based on a mix of political principles as well as moral and religious values. On December 9th, for example, two governors clasped hands after modeling respectful political dialogue at the National Cathedral in Washington. Democrat Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania and Republican Spencer Cox of Utah often share how their faith imbues their work. "Bridge building is the hardest thing I've ever done," Mr. Cox told the Washington Post. "It takes strong faith and strong courage." A couple of days later, a bipartisan group of Indiana state senators voted down a bill to redraw an electoral map to give the state's Republicans an advantage in Congress. Several cited an ethical desire to reduce partisanship. "I hope that this is the beginning of the country stepping back from the brink," said one Republican state senator. Such a stance fits research that shows how the words and actions of elected officials can cue either positive or negative public sentiment. A Cornell University political scientist who has studied the campaign approach of Mr. Cox, who refuses to demonize opponents, found it had a significant positive effect on public views. "Americans look to political leaders for moral clarity," says Governor Shapiro. "Elected officials in a few states appear to recognize this as they decide whether to abide by longstanding norms or to push redistricting to lock in wins in 2026. Texas kicked off a redistricting race mid last year, redrawing maps to favor Republican candidates. California responded with a referendum to override the independent commission and draw maps favoring Democrats. "California's gerrymandering is not fighting back. It's cheating," one California Democrat said about the move that passed in November. "It's not all just about getting reelected," Kansas State Representative Brett Fairchild, a Republican, told the New York Times. "It's also about principle and morals and ethics." Many Americans might now be seeking deeper values to guide civic life. In the dialogue series that hosted Mr. Cox and Mr. Shapiro, for example, the National Cathedral has laid out one approach. "We start with two fundamental ideas," its website notes. "First, every person is a beloved child of God, regardless of who they vote for. And second, Americans yearn for a better way to be in a relationship with one another." Perhaps the yearning has found its voice. Our next Monitor's View article is entitled, "Strength for Ukraine and Taiwan." With calm resolve, the United States and the European Union have each made recent decisions showing a firm watchfulness against big power aggression. Neither will receive a Nobel Peace Prize, as Alfred Nobel's idea of a secure world did not include military deterrence. Yet together, the U.S. and EU have helped make war a bit more unthinkable. On December 17th, the Trump administration approved the largest ever U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. Congress is expected to approve the $11.1 billion weapons package, especially after a House Select Committee on China report called for unambiguous opposition to Beijing's moves toward an invasion of the self-governing democratic island. Earlier in December, President Donald Trump issued a national security strategy that says deterring a conflict over Taiwan, ideally by preserving military overmatch, is a priority. In November, Taiwan's government proposed a $40 billion special budget for military spending, part of an effort to boost its defenses. History demonstrates that compromising with aggressors ultimately brings only endless aftermaths of war and subjugation, said President Li Qingti. On December 19th, meanwhile, EU leaders agreed to borrow 90 billion euros, or about $106 billion, to provide critical aid to Ukraine against the Russian military. The money may allow the country to survive into 2027. Ukraine will not need to repay the loan until Russia compensates it with reparations. The only way to bring Russia to the negotiating table is to strengthen Ukraine, said European Council President Antonio Costa. While the aid amount was not as much as many EU states wanted, the final figure is a decisive message for an end to the war, said Friedrich Merz, the German chancellor. Overall, Europe has spent more money than the U.S. to help Ukraine during the nearly four-year war. This latest protection for Taiwan and Ukraine, both democracies threatened by autocratic neighbors, is not a fear-based strategy. It is a recognition that showing strength against evil can dissolve its power. As the German leader said, Russian President Vladimir Putin will only make concessions once he realizes his war will not pay off. Well, as predicted, we got 7 minutes left. So I'll go back to the humanity behind the headlines section and I'll read an article. Quitting on my own terms. Why more women are exiting the workforce. This is written by Victoria Hoffman, who is a staff writer, and they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. A shift away from remote and hybrid work has driven some U.S. women out of their jobs, raising questions about how to best support women juggling work with other responsibilities. Vases of flowers and notes scribbled with messages of support are scattered throughout Hannah Kim's home in Goodyear, Arizona. Her friends and family sent them after she announced her decision to leave her job. Ms. Kim left her role as a marketing executive at an insurance carrier on December 1st after months of stricter in-person work requirements and a long commute to Phoenix made it difficult for her to maintain the care she provides to her mother at home. I felt like it was a decision that could have been avoided if the company were more about flexibility and met different kinds of employees' needs, says Ms. Kim, who was originally hired to work remotely. Ms. Kim is part of a movement of women who are leaving their jobs. More than 330,000 women ages 20 or older have left the U.S. workforce this year, according to an analysis by the National Women's Law Center. In the first half of 2025, the employment rate for mothers of children under age 5 declined by its steepest drop in 4 decades, according to research by Misty Hegenness, an associate professor at the University of Kansas who studies gender economics. The past year brought unusual pressures for employees and the highest levels of discontent in 5 years, noted a recent report on women in the U.S. workforce by Lean In, a women's advocacy group, and McKinsey & Company consultants. Return to work mandates, a federal rollback under the Trump administration of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, including some geared towards women, and a shortage of affordable care for dependents who are affecting whether women stay on the job, says Jasmine Tucker, Vice President of Research at the National Women's Law Center in Washington. The trends over time are not looking good, says Ms. Tucker. We say leaving the labor force, and it sounds like it's an option, but I think the reality is that they are being shoved out. Not everyone views a pullback of women from the paid labor force negatively. Popular right-wing podcasters like Ali Beth Stuckey and Alex Clark talk about the benefit of mothers prioritizing time with their children and say societal norms put too much pressure on women to put their careers first. Facing the flexibility stigma. During the pandemic, remote or flexible work helped usher some women into the workplace. In 2023, the percentage of prime-age working women in the 25 to 54 age range reached an all-time high of 75.3%, driven largely by an increase of college-educated women with young children. Many employers this year retreated from the remote and hybrid work that was infused into certain professional roles during the COVID-19 pandemic. The federal government required employees to return to 5 days in office, as did Amazon for its corporate staff. One study found that more than half of Fortune 100 workers this year had fully in-person policies for the first time since the pandemic. The Lean In and McKinsey report published in December found that one quarter of 124 companies surveyed scaled back or discontinuing remote or hybrid work this year. A flexibility stigma is one of the biggest factors holding women back from work, according to the report's authors, who found that employees who use flexible work arrangements are seen as less committed and are less likely to receive promotions. At the same time, costs for both child care and elder care are rising faster than inflation, which puts pressure on individuals to decide whether they can afford to remain in the workforce. In two-parent households, when we can't afford the cost of childcare, we usually send the person who is the lower-income earner home to take care of the kids, says Jessica Kriegel, Chief Strategy Officer at Cultural Partners, a consultancy group. That affects women, she adds, since the pay gap between genders has grown for the past 2 years. In addition, she notes about 80% of single-parent households are headed by women. Looking for solutions. Views on how to help women and men balance professional work with caregiving responsibilities range from greater child care support to more tax credits for parents. In November, New Mexico became the first state to provide universal government-funded child care for all families using funding from state oil and gas reserves. New York's Zoran Mondami, who was scheduled to take office as mayor when this article went to press, campaigned on a promise of universal child care. Federally, the tax and spending bill passed by Congress last summer included several provisions to support working families. Those include a permanent extension of the child tax credit, increased tax credits for employers who provide child care assistance, and tax-advantaged savings accounts for children known as Trump accounts. Policymakers can offer support by investing in parental leave and high-quality, affordable child care subsidized by the government, says Professor Hegedus at the University of Kansas. Mothers and unpaid family givers, that group of individuals in our society, are too big for us to fail them. And that's going to be a truncated article because by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.